Hi, am I starting?
Yes, you are.
Okay, cool. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the event of the evening. My name is Ariazi, and I'm on the board of the Orthodox Club. Tonight, we'll be talking to professionals in the mental health field about their field and the rapidly changing atmosphere that is the novel coronavirus. We banded as a community of college students to address the need we found most emerging and common among our peers. While the world feels like it's moving at warp speed, we need to be able to take a moment for ourselves and find help that is available to us. Before we begin, I'd like to take a moment to thank all the panelists for making time in their busy schedules to come speak with us tonight. I'd also like to thank our OUJLIC Rabbi Reuben and Rebetza Shirabashnik, who were instrumental in making tonight happen. I'd also like to thank all the clubs that came together to collaborate and make this night happen. These student organizations include OUJLIC at Brooklyn College, Tanger Hillel at Brooklyn College, Brooklyn College AEPI, Stuck in the Library, Chai Club of Tanger Hillel, the Orthodox Club, and Link. And without further ado, let's talk mental health and quarantine. But first off, as Jews always do, let's start with a prayer of Tehillim read by Mishalanu fellow Oriya Abed. Ding.
Okay, hi everyone. I'm going to be reading Perek Kuf Chaf Aleph, which is chapter 121. I'm going to read the English translation. A song for Asans. I shall rise my eyes to the mountains from where my help will come. My help is from the Lord, the maker of heaven and earth. He will not allow your foot to falter. Your guardian will not slumber. Behold, the guardian of Israel will neither slumber nor sleep. The Lord is your guardian. The Lord is your shadow. He is by your right hand. By day, the sun will not smite you, nor will the moon at night. The Lord will guard you from all evil. He will guard your soul. The Lord will guard your going out and your coming in from now and through eternity. I would now like to have Perry start by asking the first question.
Okay. Hi, everyone. So we're going to start off with having the panelists introduce themselves and tell us about, please tell us about your background and your specialty.
Hi.
Hi. So we're going to start with Miriam Turk.
Hi, good evening, everybody. Nice to virtually meet you and be part of your awesome club here. I'm a big fan of Rabbi Reuven and Shira, so I'm glad to be part of what's going on tonight. Thanks for inviting me. I am the director of Jewish outreach and recruitment at Touro's Graduate School of Social Work, and I'm also the executive director of Nefesh International. Nefesh is a member organization. We have about 850 members all over the world for Orthodox mental health professionals. Thanks for inviting me.
Thank you. Next, we're going to have Abigail Margolis.
Oh, I have to demute her. Wait.
Sorry, I was on mute. Hi, Abigail Margolis. I'm actually an alumni of Brooklyn College. That's where I got my foray into psychology, so really excited to be here. And I'm a licensed clinical psychologist. I have a private practice in Brooklyn, and I work in a group practice in Grey Neck.
Okay, thank you. Next, we're going to have Dr. Ronen Hizami.
Hi, everyone. Nice pronunciation of the last name. Most people get it wrong. Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Wait.
Can you hear me?
We don't see you.
We don't see you.
You don't see me?
Right.
What about now?
Now we see you. Welcome.
You still want to see me. Okay. So, hi, everyone. Thank you for inviting me. Happy to be back in my old stomping grounds. I, too, am a Brooklyn College graduate. I am a child, adolescent, and adult psychiatrist, which means I'm a medical doctor that also deals with mental health issues. My practice involves evaluations, medication management, and coordination of care. thank you for having me.
Thank you. Next, we will have Basia Revda.
Hi, everyone. I'm Basia. I'm a hospital social worker. I most of my patients are patients who come in for medical reasons, but also have comorbidities, either psychiatric or some sort of other diagnosis. I take care of discharge planning for them and doing supportive counseling with them and LIJ.
Okay, thank you. Next, we will have Malka, and I'm sorry if I butcher this, Akinblit.
You're muted.
Oh, wait, we got muted.
Okay, can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Okay, so my video is on screen, but it doesn't seem to be connected. Okay, thank you so much for having me. It is always an honor to participate in anything that the Boshniks are creating. Their programming is unparalleled. I am I provide clinical services as a social worker at OHealth Children's Home and Family Services. I service children, adolescents, and adults with evidence-based practices. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. Next, we will have Penny Feintuch.
Yes. Thanks so much. Hello, everyone. I'm Penny Feintuch. I'm a licensed clinical psychologist. I, too, studied psychology in Brooklyn College and loved it so much that I came back to teach. Not teaching this semester, but I've taught psychology for the past 5 years there. And currently, I also work as a psychologist in a counseling center, so hope to give some of that background tonight. And I work with a range of ages between childhood and young adulthood, with mood issues and academic issues, and provide psychotherapy and psychological assessment. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. And last but definitely not least, Rabbi Boshniks.
Hi, my name is Rabbi Reuven Boshniks. I'm a licensed mental health counselor as well. I have practiced in private practice and as well in a community clinic, the Interborough Clinic. I've also done training, couples work, and sex therapy at the NYU Medical School in their comprehensive sex therapy program. I currently am using my experience and from my experience and background in mental health and pairing it with my rabbinic ordination, working with the students on campus at Brooklyn College and providing pastoral counseling, which is informed by clinical research. Back to you, Perry.
Thank you all for being here. I am now going to pass it on to Zach with the first question.
Hello, my name is Zach. This first question is for Dr. Hizami. And the question is, what are some of the mental health challenges which are present due to the shelter in place order?
Okay, can you guys hear me and see me? Okay, great. So it's really hard to really separate out just the shelter in place order. There's so much going on in our lives today that are just so different. So I'm just going to touch on a few of them because I'm sure that my fellow panelists and I could talk just about this for several hours. First of all, you know, you have to all remember that we're social creatures. And this isolation, this, you know, shelter in place order, which keeps many of us from interacting with people we'd normally interact with, be they family, be they friends, be they just people in the regular world that we're used to interacting with, the guy at 7-Eleven or Starbucks where we get coffee in the morning. So the lack of that social connectedness really plays a role in our lives and can affect us dramatically. In addition to the isolation, when you're isolated and you're hearing all this horrible news and you're on these websites that talk about, you know, every third or fourth person dying, and you're on, you know, Death Watch websites looking to see who's dying next. You know, it gets really, really scary. When you're locked inside, you know, you kind of start to, your mind can start to wonder and say, kind of, what's really going on out there? you know, there's fear about access to basic necessities like food and other necessities. When this first started, and before I realized how serious this was, I was joking around saying that this was the toilet paper apocalypse. You know, it's exciting now when you go into a store and there's toilet paper on the shelves. And it's unfortunately, it's a real thing that, you know, people are very, very insecure and wondering, you know, is there going to be meat on the shelves? Am I going to be able to buy food when I finally do go out? For those people that are suffering from mental health issues even before this, there's really a concern about whether they're going to be able to access their care. Can they get to see their therapist in person? Will they be able to see their therapist on video or talk to them on the phone? You know, a lot of therapists are home with their kids, and a lot of them are taking care of their kids during the day, and they're not available between 9 and 5 to have the usual sessions that they have. The lack of sunlight is a huge thing for people that are isolating in place, especially, you know, I live up in Rockland County in Muncie, so I have a, you know, huge backyard. I have a deck. I can go out even when I had the coronavirus, about 2 months ago, I was still able to go out on my deck. I was able to walk around my property and not worry about getting anybody sick. I was able to get some sunlight. Don't discount how important it is to get outside and breathe fresh air. And when people don't have that, especially folks that are living in cities, it can really affect people profoundly and affect their mental health. And leading into some other issues here, there's the effect of the powerlessness. What does that mean? I can't go out. I'm used to going out, especially for young folks like those that are in the crowd tonight. You know, you're not used to having something in your life that you can't surmount. You know, I can go, I can come, I can do this, I can do that, and I can always recover because I'm young and I'm healthy. And I can't go out. And I'm used to going out, especially for young folks like those that are. Oops. Can you guys hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. I started to hear myself. So that powerlessness can really feed on our fears and bring out a lot of insecurities that we have. And of course, you know, there was this great clip that a few people sent me on Facebook of this blonde lady who looked like she was standing at a few mics, like she was a newscaster or a politician, and she's describing, gee, you know, this is all you have to do to survive the coronavirus. And then she went through quite with tremendous humor, all the various contradictory statements that were coming out. So this fear of not knowing what to do, and today it's okay to go out, and tomorrow it's not okay to go out, and today it's okay for young people to get it, and tomorrow young people are dying. All of this is magnified. The fear of the unknown is magnified when we're isolated. And of course, just leading into the next question, is really when we're isolated and we're not able to live in the regular rhythms of our lives, that change of structure, that change of schedule throws off so much. It can throw off our sleep. It can throw off our eating patterns. It throws off so much that can just exacerbate or even cause certain problems to come out. Hello?
Hey, Perry. Perry, back to you.
There we go. Yeah. Sorry. It just wouldn't unmute. So the next question, we're going to start with Penny Feintop. We have seen a breakdown of schedules and the normal rhythms of life. This makes many people lack motivation to do anything. What can we do to help ourselves be productive?
Yeah, it's a great question. And like Dr. Azami really laid the foundation of how there is a major breakdown in routine and what we would call normal life. A lot of people can feel this lack of motivation, difficulty concentrating on schoolwork or other basic activities that you really need to get done. So I want to first focus on what could be an individual struggle before focusing on these basic general tips. So it's important to look inward, get a little more understanding of why you're having particular difficulty focusing on studying for this exam that's coming up and kind of got to study, but somehow you're watching Tiger King instead. So a lot of times when you're really stressed or you're experiencing a major change in your mood, that has a direct effect on your ability to focus, your ability to motivate yourself to do simple things or things that you had previously found simple. So first to look inward and identify those things and be able to address those things together with family, with your therapist, with other support systems. That, I would say, is primary. Once you're doing that and addressing those things and you want further hacks on how to be able to push through, say, till the end of the semester or just push through until whenever this changes, creating a very detailed schedule is really helpful for a lot of people, especially college age. If it's, you know, color-coded, I've worked with students who go wild with this highlighting or printing out things which are really detailed, not just focusing on when you're going to be doing work, but also outlining significant amount of time for breaks and for you time, socializing. Those are really important things to do. Also, when you are setting out time for tasks, really important to be realistic. And it can really make it even more difficult when you say, yeah, I'm going to read 70 pages of this textbook in the next hour and then feel really crummy and eat an entire box of cookies because you didn't. So that's why it's really important when you are setting the schedule and setting these tasks to be realistic. And one more tip that I think is really helpful and research really supports is if you know there's something that you really want to do, if you really want to hang out with friends, if you really want to read that new book that you finally, you know, would like to crack open, first, and this takes some self-control, first begin to finish that task. Well, do that first step of the task. You're going to complete this section of your term paper, and then you can read a chapter of your book. That's really effective in increasing your motivation.
Thank you. Dr. Hazami, do you have anything to add, or did you?
Yes, I'd like to add a few things, although Dr. Feintuch really covered most of my list as well. One of the things that I want to introduce here is that, can you guys hear me?
Yes.
Okay, excellent. So one of the things I want to introduce here is that these are unprecedented times, and you guys have to just ease up on yourselves. You know, you have to ease up on your expectations of yourselves. The rules are different. You know, we're in a new reality now. So in addition to just to reiterate, to making a schedule and keeping to it, how about exercise? You know, when you're stuck inside, you don't realize how much you were walking around and going from place to place and climbing steps, and none of that is happening, or very little of that is happening. So to just keep yourself healthy, physically and emotionally, it's very, very important to exercise. It can also help you to be much more productive. You should also try to get out. So even if it's putting on a mask and walking around, just get out, change your environment a little bit. So I have patients that I'm telling, you know, one day drive to this state park, the next day drive to the beach, the next day drive here or drive there, just to get out and to provide some variety in their days. Don't forget about keeping up with your social connections, even though it's not the same, but get on with Zoom or any other social media where you can see a person's face and really connect with them. Guys, I think the junk food is selling out faster than regular food, or at least it was in the beginning of this crisis. Don't forget that eating healthy really affects our productivity, just like exercise affects our productivity. So try to eat healthy. Try to not eat emotionally. Try to eat healthy. And the other thing is, you know, we all have all this extra time on our hands. There are all these wonderful new interests that we can explore that can take our minds off of what's going on a little bit and give us a break from what we're trying to accomplish with schoolwork or other work, and just kind of give us a chance to refresh a little bit that can really empower us and give us the energy to kind of tackle what we need to do.
Thank you very much. The next question is for a couple people, Dr. Margolis first, then Rabbi Boshnak, and then Miriam Turk. How can we deal with not knowing when the COVID restrictions will be lifted and what the future will look like? So first I'll ask Dr. Margolis.
Yeah, so I think this is actually like everyone's, you know, big question, right? When is everything going to change? How do I know what my day tomorrow, next week, next month, the summer, next semester might look like? And I think that this is really what's driving a lot of the worry for everybody, because at its core, what anxiety is really fear of not knowing or fear of uncertainty. So the first thing is that it's totally normal to be freaked out and concerned, not knowing what the reality will look like and when this will change. So when you're noticing these feelings, I think the first thing to do is to take a moment and recognize that this makes sense, that it's really stressful, and give yourself that acknowledgement that this is a really hard time and that it is really hard not to know. What I would do next is actually to try to lean into not knowing and embrace it a little bit. Tolerating uncertainty is a big part of any work that you do with anxiety. So accepting that we cannot know when this is going to change and that that's really hard is actually the first step sometimes in relieving some of the discomfort around it. And I know Rabbi Boshnak is very into, you know, mindfulness. So whenever you notice getting pulled into worries about the future, concerns about how things are going to look, to try to take a moment, recognize that, you know, you're being pulled away from the present and you don't know. So try to focus on what you're doing in the here and now. What do I need to accomplish in the next hour? You know, if you're eating healthy food, ideally, eat it mindfully. If you're working on a school paper, work on that. And when you notice your mind kind of wandering, because that's what minds do, they just tend to wander to worries about the future, recognize it, give yourself that acknowledgement that it makes sense to be worried, and there is no way to know. So accepting that and bringing yourself back to the present moment.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Boshnak.
And thank you, Doctor. I would also add, you know, that like we said, give yourself the permission to be not okay. Don't judge the fact that you're feeling, I should be able to, as they would say, man up. I should be able to deal with this. I should be able to handle this. What's wrong with me? The beginning days of this, and now every couple of days, I'll take a moment just to cry to myself that I feel totally out of control. And that's okay. And I own that. I'm totally behind that. It's okay, as I like to say, even my kids say it after me now, it's okay not to be okay. It's okay. Where Dr. Izami said, we're in unprecedented times. This is all weird. We are out of control. That's okay. A second thought that also tends to creep into your mind, as Dr. Margolis said, that taking you out of the present, saying, oh my God, I can't do this until September. I can't do this until until June. I can't do this until next January, whatever the new estimate which comes out on the news, and you say, I can't do this. I can't handle this. You don't have to last until June. You don't have to last into January. You have to make it into the next moment. You have to make it into the next hour. You don't have to, you don't have to run the 26 miles. You have to run the next 25 feet. And you can do that. You can do that. You've done it before. You can do that. So that's the other piece that I would add.
Thank you very much. And Miriam Turk?
So I'm going to try not to be repetitive of my colleagues, but I think the way we can deal with it is to know that there's no script for it. This is ambiguous. This is new and it's completely unpredictable. So I think part of us, just like if we can kind of let it wash over us, that there are no rights and wrongs here, to normalize it. And what I mean by normalize it is to understand that this kind of worry that we're feeling now is kind of a normal reaction to a really not normal situation. And with that said, anxiety and worry are part of the human condition. And the question is where that worry may become a problem. That's what we kind of have to keep in check. When it becomes a problem, when it gets in the way of living the way you want to live, and the kind of life that you want to lead. But with that said, you know, we're human beings. We think ahead. We plan, we problem solve, we fix things, we anticipate. Surprise, not now. We can't do any of those things that we're kind of wired to do and that we're used to doing. So it's really a whole new deal. And like I said before, there's not really a script to it. There's a whole section of psychology, actually. You might want to Google it when we're done sometime tonight, is the psychology of uncertainty. You may not have heard about that before, but it's a fascinating part of psychology where they're talking about, like, when certainty is questioned, which is what we're doing now all the time, what we thought was certain is now something that we're not so certain about, our stress level raises. So when our stress level raises, we got to kind of do something to keep that in check, be aware of it, talk about it, reach out, and understand, again, that there's no rule book. So there's no right or wrong. And I think one of the other things to really, really keep in mind is speak to yourself with compassion. Be nice to yourself. Being nice to yourself is, you know, might be having a piece of chocolate, but that's not all what I mean. I really mean speak to yourself about what's going on now and how we need to be nicer to ourselves, not only to one another, but we need to have compassion for ourselves because we're treading on new ways of living and new ways of communicating. And it could be that there will be things that we learn about this, about ourselves and about others at this time, that we will be able to be better communicators afterwards. We're not sure yet because we're not in the after yet, but be compassionate with yourself.
Thank you very much. I also want to mention to everyone viewing, you are encouraged to ask questions. So after all the formal questions are asked, please, we will answer them. Please message either the rabbi privately or any of the co-hosts privately.
Okay. The next question will be for first Malka Akinblit and then Miriam Turk. Due to the shelter in place order, there is a great degree of social isolation. How can people cope with loneliness? Malka Akinblit?
Hi, can you hear me clearly? Can you hear me clearly?
There's a little bit of a lag, Malka. We can hear you, but it's a little bit choppy.
Okay. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Oh my gosh, hello. That got like 1,000 times better. Yes.
Okay, fantastic. Okay. So, yeah. So when we're speaking about loneliness, I'm going to also try not to be repetitive with the colleagues, so to address some new pieces here. And when we look at loneliness, there are really two aspects of it. There's the relationship with ourselves, right? I think we've all heard people before say, I'm in a room with people, but I feel lonely. And there's also of course, the social connection that we are all deprived of to some level with everyone around us. So loneliness, from a psychological perspective, it has been a public health concern before Corona, and to the point that the UK has like a minister of loneliness set up, and they have a whole policy in terms of how to address that. And we definitely want to speak about loneliness because we want to remove any stigma associated with loneliness. There should be the way people see themselves, the way people see others, and realizing disconnecting any shame from the experience of loneliness. So just some skills to mention how to navigate loneliness. When we think about the fact that now our connections have switched to phone and video interactions, we want to realize that that creates an opportunity to go deeper into the quality of our connections because there's other reception that we're missing. So now we have to be creative in how we connect, and quality of relationships is very important in a world where we're focused on quantity and followers and Facebook friends and all of those pieces there. So so creativity, as was mentioned before, and again, we want to make sure the creativity is internally motivated, not externally. It's not that we're so pressured because we see all these things that we have to catch up with everyone, but something that truly, truly gives you that fix. Research shows that creativity is certainly effective. Mindfulness, as Dr. Margolis mentioned, especially mindfulness when we are reaching out and helping someone else, we end up fully engaging in another person's world. So that is, mindfulness is all about fully experiencing something. So reaching out to support others allows you to really be mindful. And of course, is imagination, realizing that this will have an end, and imagining that future, and of course, rest, because contrary to people thinking, oh, you have all this time, and when people are navigating situations where they're independent, that could be heavy, and it's important to take the rest of people.
Okay, thank you. Miriam Turk, do you have anything to add?
Sure, just a couple comments that, like Dr. Hazami said before, humans don't just like to be social, but we need to be social. Even those who are a little bit quieter or introverted, for lack of a better word, even people who are a little bit introverted need to be social. So the question is how to do that under these circumstances. So at the risk of sounding cliche, you know, being alone, whether you're in an apartment alone, a house alone, whatever the case may be, being alone doesn't automatically mean that you're lonely. So let's kind of define a couple of those terms just for our conversation that we can have now and maybe afterwards. You can be alone without being lonely. So we kind of need a little bit more information or definitions about that. A person is alone when he's physically alone by himself. It's a physical state. That's being alone. When a person is lonely, it's more of a psychological and an emotional state. He may feel abandoned or sad due to the circumstances that he's living through. So those are two kind of basic definitions of that. So you can be lonely in a crowd, but you're not alone. Some of this requires, you know, motivation in terms of if we're spending so much time by ourselves, we might need to be a little bit more active in the process under the circumstances as opposed to passive. So we might need to be a little bit more creative about, we can't go out to dinner with a friend, but I can Zoom chat while I'm having dinner and my friend is having dinner. So we're having dinner together in the best way possible. So again, I'm physically alone, but I don't have to be psychologically or emotionally alone. I think those are a couple of things to really keep in mind as we're kind of making our way through this new map of what life looks like. We have to kind of cultivate social interactions in the absence of physical proximity. So again, it's tricky, but part of the way to do it is to try to do it with somebody else. And I think that helps, even while you may be sitting alone. Again, because it doesn't mean that you're necessarily lonely. And let's also not confuse boredom with loneliness. Sometimes people get really bored and, oh my gosh, I'm lonely. Well, might not be the case. So a little bit of that self-talk and mindfulness, as some of my colleagues were saying, might be, you know, good to kind of keep that in mind at that time, because just because we're bored doesn't mean I've got no friends and it doesn't mean I'm lonely. It might be, I might just need to use my time a little bit more wisely. Anything else I want to mention to make sure that I hit here? Yes, the recent research, as you can imagine, a lot of this is coming out now because of our circumstances, has shown that, the key element and difference between being lonely and alone is being alone and connected. So the question is to keep connected. The question is find new ways to be connected and find new ways that despite the lack of physical proximity that we could still be connected to others.
Great, thank you. So just before I ask this next question, I would just like to remind everyone, if you are on Zoom watching, you can ask a question by messaging one of the co-hosts your questions. And if you're on Facebook Messenger, you can comment your question directly on the stream. Just mention who you would like the question
directed at. There's a chat button on the bottom of everyone's screen. Yeah. And if you put it in the chat bar, then we'll all get it and then we'll be able to ask it later on.
Right. For those on the Facebook stream, if you comment on the stream, you can ask a question, or if you would like to keep it private, you can privately message Rabbi Boshnak. Cool. So, on to the next question. This question is for Basia Brevda and Penny Feintuch. And the question is, in our lockdown lifestyle, since we're not meeting you in your office, what can we expect from a telehealth visit? Can you describe what the experience is like? And Basia, you can go first.
From the hospital perspective, it's definitely very different than a clinical from, you know, someone who's going to a clinic. In the past, where we would have met with the patient in their room or met with the patient family in a conference room, we are now doing 75% of our communication with patients and family over the phone. We don't have access to video chat with our patients. So we only are able to, in order to, you know, eliminate as much of the possibility of spreading the virus, we're really, for the most part, doing phone calls to the patients in their room and phone calls to the family members. 25% of it, we are going into the rooms for, you know, for whatever circumstances, we may have to go meet with the patient in the room, but we are trying to eliminate as much as possible of spreading the virus. So it is a little bit more challenging because we're facial expressions and hand gestures are a lot of communication that gets lost when we're on the phone. So we do try as much as we can, you know, to, we're trying to, like, you know, use our voices to communicate that we're listening, that we're understanding, whereas a nod usually to express our patients that we're listening, that we're present, would usually let them know that we're there. We now have to make sure to be very verbal over the phone, be very expressive verbally to let them know that we're with them, we're listening to them, and to address any of their concerns. So it's definitely a different experience. It's definitely a little bit of a disconnect, but we are, you know, we're doing whatever we can to try and make sure that they feel comfortable over the phone and make sure that we're addressing all their questions and any of their concerns.
Cool. Thank you so much, Basia. And Penny?
Sure. So I'll talk more from the college counseling side. So my counseling center, and I believe Brooklyn College as well, is doing everything over video conferencing. So Zoom is my life. I'm sure it's many of yours as well. And this, I guess my answer applies for people who are in therapy and want to, are continuing, and also people who are interested in actually starting therapy at this time. And you know, I'm sure many of you are thinking about that as well, since we're in these unprecedented times. So first, I always have a conversation about how this is a very different type of therapy. It's not in person. There can be a lot of things that can be lost, as Basia was saying, you know, over the phone and over video. It's not like you're having an in-person interaction. So it's important for your therapist to bring that up. And if your therapist doesn't, I would encourage you to bring that conversation up. You know, issues of privacy, you know, making sure that you have a private room to discuss things. And for a lot of people, that is a challenge. And having that conversation and troubleshooting is really important. Another thing that I think a lot about is, well, I know Brooklyn College is a commuter school, but there may be some of you who are not based in New York. Don't assume that you can't get services from your college counseling center that's based in New York or in a different state. Definitely reach out to see if you can get some sort of support from them. And I know that I've been able to work with students across the U.S. Since these are very different times. And in terms of contents, a lot of it is focusing on basic needs and finances and thing and major disruptions. And I would say a good chunk of therapy is also therapy as normal. So for any people who are thinking of seeking support, I would definitely encourage you to do so.
Thank you very much. The next question is for Rabbi Boshnak, Dr. Hazami, and Miriam Turk. Why are some people dealing with quarantine better than other people? So, Rabbi Boshnak?
I think the primary you know, answer to this question is that people are different. People take in information differently. People process information differently. People have different experiences. Despite the fact that we've said that these are very new and different times, we operate oftentimes on schema. You know, on different unwritten or what's the word I'm looking for, mentally written laws in our head based on previous experiences. We're lifelong learners. And based on our what we've experienced, then we try to apply the old rules to a new situation. As a result, so we'll try to say that this situation is like, you know, something that I've previously gone through. And that was scary, and this is scary. Well, we've all had different experiences. Everybody, you know, processes this information differently. I would also add, and I've thought that we compare this also to the way that a person, you know, looks at the what they're experiencing in terms of a sense of grief and loss also. You know, oftentimes we think of grief and loss when somebody passes away, but also when we're talking about a life that I thought that I would have, or experiences that I thought that I would have. The world has changed, and I'm not ready for it to change yet. We make sense of this also at different paces, and it isn't necessarily even a linear thing that we move through this, that through these experiences differently. So some days I'll be up and some days I'll be down. Some days I'm doing well with it and some days I'm not. So there's a whole bunch of different factors. Like I alluded to this earlier when I said, like, when you feel like I should be, in your mind, you're saying I should be able to deal with this. I should be able to handle this because maybe my friend, my sibling, my parents, and I don't understand why I'm not. It's because you're wired differently. And accepting that, and you know, leading into it and owning that, you know, well, is an incredibly healthy thing to do. Pushing back and asking myself why haven't I moved on? Why is it so tough for me? It only compounds the dysfunction for you. It only compounds the pain for you. I say that this is the way that I'm feeling, and I accept that, and I embrace that, and that can give you the ability to actually move on.
Thank you very much, Dr. Hazami.
Okay, so I'm going to take a step back for a second and look at this more as a global issue. So when we deal with why people react differently to different situations, this really is not a discussion that's only about dealing with quarantine. It's really, and I'm going to talk about looking at how we react from different perspectives for a second. So just bear with me for a minute. But we can look at this from a genetic perspective. Okay, the way that we react to things is partially genetically imprinted. You can have people that react differently to trauma, okay, and part of that is based on their genetic programming. We also have people's personality types. And just to speak in very, very broad strokes, people that are internalizers versus people that are externalizers. So that outgoing person who's really, really super duper expressive is going to be able to handle certain situations better than someone who's an internalizer, someone who keeps more to themselves, who may be more anxious or shy, for example, and vice versa. And I have to tell you, I have been shocked with some of my patients, because if you would ask me to predict which of my patients would have done a better job with this lockdown and which would have done worse, I have been shocked at how wrong I have been in so many cases. Now, in addition to this, we can't ignore that certain people have certain types of pathologies. There are some people that, for example, are socially anxious. So those people may be thriving now. People that have a hard time going to school, interacting with people outside of their very, very immediate circle, they're loving this. They love that they don't have to go to class. They love that they don't have to interact. They love, in the classes that no one's picking on them and asking them to contribute, they love that they don't have to sit there, you know, in dread. Who's going to call on me? Am I going to make a fool of myself? Other things, and I'm going to leave some room for Miriam Turk to answer a little bit too, but another big factor is what are those reserves that we have to fall back on? Do we have a social circle? Do we have family support? Do we have other interests that we can bolster ourselves with? So these are some of the things, but again, just some of them, some of the things that will go into why some people will do better than others in reacting to the quarantine or really in reacting to anything else.
Thank you very much. And now, Miriam, do you have anything to add?
Yeah, a couple of points. Just let me rewrite my notes a little bit because I don't want to be, again, don't want to be repetitive. But the obvious, what we've already stated, is that everyone reacts differently to stressful situations. Like I said before, there's no script. How you respond to a pandemic, how you respond to an outbreak of something like this can depend on a few things. Your background, like was said, your support systems is another thing to keep in mind, and a pre-existing condition, whether that be physical or emotional, mental health-wise. Some are better at asking for help, and other needs to get better at. Other people need to get better at it. I'm one of those ones that need to get better at it. I've learned, as hopefully we've all learned, a little bit more about ourselves over these things, and that is something I know that I need to work on, and I kind of got to embrace it and take it for what it is, and again, be compassionate to myself that's just how I'm wired, and be accepting of that. You know, different people are reacting differently. You got a couple of categories. You've got some people who are trying to retain a feeling of control while all this out of control stuff is going on, either by ignoring the stay-at-home orders or defying them, and they're kind of just making their own rules. Other people are oppositional in nature and routinely defy authority. There's that group of people who are, you know, walking through this pandemic. And there are others that are just in denial. Especially if they aren't in the hardest hits like we are living in New York, New Jersey, they're kind of in denial, and they may not even know anybody with the virus. So it's a couple of different kind of categories of people. And again, going back to the fact that they have or they don't have support systems, or they have or they don't have pre-existing conditions mentally or emotionally, that all takes its toll. Now, of course, our hope is that nobody has to encounter this kind of stress. No one has to encounter a pandemic like this. No one has to encounter trauma. But the reality is that most of us do in one form or another. So if we do, I'm not going to say that trauma is good, but I am going to say that since crisis is inevitable for us as human beings, one additional way to experience trauma is to possibly look for growth within trauma. So as I said before, there's a whole psychology of uncertainty. There's also a whole psychology you might want to Google about post-traumatic growth. You've all heard about post-traumatic stress disorder, but there's also a category of learning of post-traumatic growth. Sounds a little bit funny, but it's really defined as change that's experienced as a level due to a level of adversity like we're all kind of experiencing now, and helps us to rise to a higher level of functioning. And I can discover three things, and with this I'll certainly close. I can discover about myself that I'm stronger than I thought I was. I know now better that I can handle very great difficulties that I didn't think I could handle before, just like Dr. Azami was saying about some of his patients. And number three, in this whole experience that we're having and the time that we're alone and we're thinking about what our, you know, reassessing our life situations, I may have changed my priorities about what's important to me in life. And all of those kinds of things are growing experiences. So I'm not trying to put on rose-colored glasses, but these are certain ways that we can deal with quarantine in a way that might help us grow. And not only look at it as a negative experience.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. So this question is for Dr. Abigail Margolis. What can I do for a friend who is having a hard time living the corona life? What can we do, and when should we tell them to speak to a professional?
Yeah, I love this question. I mean, I don't know anybody who's not having a hard time with the corona life. So I think we probably mean like an extra hard time. But I specifically love this question because I'm biased. I think relationships are the most important thing, and it's really one of my focuses with clients. So I love that you're thinking about how to help a friend or a loved one who's struggling with this. So the first thing, and Miriam actually mentioned this, that there's a difference between being alone and lonely. Social distancing, I do not like that word because it represents that we have to be distant socially, and that's not actually what it means. It's actually physical distancing that the CDC is recommending. And I think it's really important to remember that you can still be social even without being physically close. So I actually celebrated my birthday throughout this whole crisis. And I got more phone calls and texts and can I Uber you ice cream and can I buy you lunch than I ever did. So that was fun for me. But I think that we have to step out of that mindset that just because we can't physically be with someone, we can't emotionally support them. And that might mean sending them stuff. It might mean texting them. I'm thinking of you. How's your day going? Funny memes. I'm surviving by the funny memes that are coming out of this. Just so if anybody has funny memes, feel free to send them to me. You know, there are really ways to be there for them. And when they are talking about their struggles, you know, the best thing you can do really is not try to make it better, not make lemonade. Like Rabbi said, it's okay to not be okay. And that's something that we need to tell ourselves. And it's something that we can just communicate to our friends. So reflect back what they're saying. This really sucks. It's so hard. So what you're saying is that it was really stressful today because, you know, fill in the blank. And this is really the best thing that we can do. And it actually really does help people feel supported. In terms of when to refer to a professional, when to recommend therapy. So Mira mentioned, right, like when we're not living the life that we want to. Nobody right now is living their ideal life. Everyone's sleep schedule, food schedule is completely out of whack. So then how would we know? And I think the main thing to look out for is how distressing is it for this person? Like how uncomfortable is it making them? And how much is it really interfering with their ability to function at the level that many people can function now, right? So I might be waking up every hour, but they're not sleeping at all. Or I might be eating a little bit more or a little bit less, but they're not eating at all. Or they're, you know, so these are things to look out for is like, is it totally outside of the realm of the normal disruption that we're all living with? And is it really distressing to them?
Thank you. The next question is, what advice can be given to people who are sheltering in place in a difficult home or an abusive home? First, we will hear from Penny Feinta.
Sure. So this is a really great and complex question since there's such a spectrum of difficult family situations. So I'd like to start with maybe the most extreme or one of the more extreme situations for those people who are dealing with that type of chaotic type of environment. And now that might be ongoing throughout the year. And now it became much more difficult because they're kind of stuck. So the first thing I would really want to highlight is physical safety and getting some sort of contingency emergency safety plan. So that might include having a space in the house or in the apartment where you know you can be safe, either from someone's fists or from their words. If there's a lock on your door, that's great. If not, try to strategize having a heavy piece of furniture or something there we can prop up against the door to make sure that there cannot be an entry, and then a good pair of headphones. If that's not possible, and or if you have access to a car, try to have your keys on hand or a pair of keys on hand, that would be amazing. As well as contacting a close friend. And, you know, obviously you're not going for sleepovers on a typical night, but having an arrangement and talking with them and seeing if they would be okay if things get really out of hand, if you can crash by them until this storm subsides, whether in your house or storm in the world. And I say this, is really important, even if you never use those plans, just to know that you have that safety plan can be so empowering, and you will know that you're not stuck. You know that you have this go bag, you have a bag with your clothes and other necessities, and you can grab and you can get out of this situation if need be. That's on a more extreme side. If, say, you're dealing with a lot of difficult interactions, say emotional abuse or name calling, I would say that it's important to always stand up for yourself, but also to choose your battles. And I'm working with some students who a lot of times they get involved in a lot of family conflict. Say the mom and sister are always fighting about whatever they're fighting about. And then the student I'm working with feels obliged to stick up for her sister. And that's great, and she really has the best of intentions, but that really affects her mental health. So I'm working with her to figure out how she can choose her battles and perhaps extricate herself from certain conflicts. And that's been really helpful for her. And then for those who are just dealing with difficult interactions, people's tempers can be really short, even if there isn't a level of abuse or very difficult, chaotic environments, it can be really helpful to work on communication. And communication really starts within, to be aware of what you're feeling and then to communicate to the other person. And you know, I think that sometimes we overlook this. We try to communicate without being aware of how you're feeling. And then using the I statements, I like to say that an I statement doesn't mean I feel like you're a jerk. It's I feel whatever you're feeling. I felt really upset or neglected when you just called me a name and didn't, or you saw that I was upset and didn't check in on me.
Thank you. Malka Akinblatt?
Yes. So just to go off of the spectrum, as Dr. Feinsuch was mentioning, that there are situations where you might be in a difficult situation. So, and that point, it's helpful to remember. I say this to the kids I work with. I say this to the adolescents and the adults, that in most family settings, there are aspects that are challenging, and then there are aspects that are operating well. So shifting focus in a situation that is challenging and focusing on the aspects that are operating well is one of the ways to handle that. Also to realize just because something is your problem, it's not your problem to solve in the action sense. So there might be things that people that are struggling with, but if there's some boundaries you could set where you really, it's not your position to solve that. So we also for people to seek external supports, right? If you keep driving your car and your needs into a place where it says there's no parking available, you want to stop trying to park there. So that's another piece with that. Now, of course, if we're moving over to dealing with someone who is emotionally abusive, it helps, as Dr. Feinsuch has mentioned, you to understand their triggers, to understand your triggers. Triggers are what sets them off, what sets you off about them. You could plan more effectively for that. And of course, emotional abuse is not something a person should tolerate. It has its impact on people, and that we have to be mindful of that. Even though people might not see the bruises, it has an impact, and people should try to certainly in the long term plan for other environments. And in those situations, distraction can be very helpful. A good pair of headphones, right? Any kind of grounding with the five senses, listening to things, eating something soothing. All of that can be helpful in those situations. Now, when we're moving on to a threat to physical safety, as some excellent key points were mentioned about how to navigate that, we also want to be mindful that we have community resources. We have Shalom Task Force, and they can be reached at 718-337-3700. That's a hotline that an individual can call anonymously. They don't have to have a plan to leave the situation. They will speak to you, identify a way to safety plan in the situation. Another important piece to realize is that when you're living with someone abusive to that extent, they need power. They need power over their space. So giving them space, giving them like, this is your space, this is your room, this is this, can give the person their own space, and the hotline will help you identify what could be a safe room. It might not be the kitchen most likely, or the bathroom. So that can definitely be identified. Also, you can have a secret code with a friend, where a friend could call the hotline. And additionally, it's important to realize that, as you know, as a community, this is something that it's and many times in life, it's good to stay in your own lane, and it's important to. But sometimes, if you see something that's not being addressed, you know, you want to get out of your lane. You want to realize that there's, oh hell, we're here. We have a domestic violence shelter. There's Shalom Task Force. There are resources that will walk friends through the process. So nobody is alone in this. It's really as simple as a call. And sometimes I've worked with a woman where at a certain point in her past, her only external resource was
asking a stranger for money, and she was able to process that. So please don't feel alone in the process for family members, and we could be reached at all of these different places.
In the chat, I don't know if you guys can hear me, but we put up on the chat a book of resources that goes through all the resources that are in Brooklyn. So check it out. We're going to email it to anybody who left an email when they registered. And also all the panelists are also listed and how to contact them as well.
Shira, I don't think it came up on the chat yet.
It was sent. Let me see. You don't see it?
I don't. Oh, other people see it. Okay, great.
We're gonna email it out after as well, and we'll put it out on Facebook. And it's beautifully done. Thank you, guys.
Yeah, thanks for you ladies that put all that work together. That's a really amazing piece of work.
Really is.
Okay. Hi.
There. We can't hear you, Shira.
Okay, Shira, we stand you, but we can't hear you.
How about?
I think just turn the computer towards
How
you.
Can someone manage doing therapy while at home with their family if their family doesn't know that they are in therapy? And about all the difficulties that they're going through.
That's for me, right? Okay, great. So if you're in therapy, good for you. I think it's the kindest thing that you can do for yourself. And I want to make it very clear that being in therapy is nothing that anyone needs to feel embarrassed or ashamed about. And if people don't feel comfortable sharing, that's also respectable. So there's a really big difference between something being private and something being a secret. And it's important to remember that if you don't want people to know that you're in therapy, it doesn't mean that therapy is embarrassing. It just might mean that this is information that you want to keep to yourself. So if this is information that you want to keep to yourself, then it would be about problem solving. How do I maintain privacy around my sessions while still not disclosing that I'm in therapy? And Dr. Feintuch mentioned, you know, trying to find a space that's private. So cars are a really great place if you have access to that. You know, all of the home devices like Google Home, Alexa, they can work as noise machines. You can put that outside of your room. You know, you can even tell your family, like, please don't disturb me, like I'm doing something important. Or I'm making a phone call. You don't necessarily have to say why. If you do decide that this is something that you feel comfortable sharing, what's really important to remember is whenever you have any information that you want to disclose to anyone, you really do get to control the narrative and decide how much you want to share. So if you want to let people know, like, hey, I'm in therapy on Thursdays at 2 p.m., please don't disturb me, and that's it, that's totally fine. If you want to say, I've been struggling with anxiety for this long, that's also fine. Figure out in advance what you feel comfortable sharing, and then have that conversation with your family, you know, in a really confident way, so shoulders back, a nice smile, confident voice, and say whatever statement you came up with. I'm in therapy on Thursdays at 2 p.m. I find it really helpful. I'm asking if you could just respect my privacy for that hour. And if that's all you want to say, and you know, you have family members that want to ask more questions, you can very, very calmly just broken record it. So over and over, say the thing that you feel comfortable saying, right? Like, thank you so much for asking. I'm in therapy on Thursdays. And you just say it over and over until they get really bored. Don't change the script. Don't let them kind of sidetrack you into another conversation. Really just calm, broken record is really a good skill for assertive communication in general. And so, you know, even if you want to share, but you don't feel comfortable necessarily sharing all the details, there is a way that you can have power in that conversation.
Thank you. So the next question, we're going to start with Basia. How do you feel the current situation changed the community, communal life, and institution?
How does it change how each person celebrates and mourns? What psychological impact does that have?
So I'm going to focus again on the hospital community and patients, you know, relationships in the hospital. In the, you know, before this all happened, we, you know, patients had multiple visitors coming into their rooms to visit them, and to have, you know, they had a lot of social interactions with staff members. People would be popping in and out to see how they're doing. The dietitians would be coming in to, you know, discuss with them what they wanted to eat and having conversation with them. And now it's very, very limited access to each room. Patients are actually not allowed to be leaving their rooms. They're really kind of stuck in their rooms until they're discharged to prevent spreading. So we, you know, the staff members as a whole, we've all been, you know, reaching out via telephone or just even opening the door and, you know, saying hi from afar. We very much encourage patients and patients' family members to give them calls if anyone has friends, to give them calls and to video chat with them, but it is a solitary feeling over there. So it's definitely has been having effect on our patients, where, you know, spouses can't come in to speak with, you know, to stay with them. So we definitely encourage a lot of phone calls. Anytime I'm speaking with a family member, I'm asking them, have you spoken to your family member in the hospital today? Reach out to them. You know, we're doing a lot of encouragement for phone calls to the patients. In terms of celebration, in the past, we make birthday parties for our patients, and everyone would be singing and dancing for the patients, and, you know, going in and, you know, like really celebrating. You know, it's hard that they're in the hospital, but we really try to, you know, boost morale. Now what we'll really do is we'll send in a birthday cake, and the staff members will stand outside the room and, you know, do a little dance. We'll have a disco light outside in the hallway, put music on the speakers, and really, really try to give them, you know, a little bit of a celebration. Again, we also, we've been constantly encouraging the patients, family members to really, and friends to really, really reach out to your, you know, to the patients in the hospital, to give, you know, it's just an uplifting a feeling for them when they get all these phone calls. The mourning process is definitely stunted. You know, we have patients who have lost family members while they're here in the hospital. And so they're, you know, where in the past, you know, they have family supports holding their hands, you know, and being there for the patient. We really don't have that kind of personal touch right now, something that they're very much lacking. So, you know, we for any of those patients, we're definitely, you know, constantly on the phone with them. How are you doing? You know, what is there that we can do for you? You know, giving a lot of supportive counseling as much as we can through the telephone, but it is definitely a challenge for those patients in the hospital. But again, you know, they really feel the connection there when, you know, the staff members are outside their door, you know, because everyone's geared up, you know, they'll really put their hands around each other, the staff members, and do a virtual hug for the patient. So we really, really do try to do as much as we can to provide whatever supports we can in the hospital. But again, it's definitely very, very different than what a patient would experience under other circumstances. And, you know, what we have found, you know, what I found with my patients is that, you know, when I've been asking how they're doing, there's a, you know, there definitely is a higher level of, you know, a depressive state for our patients. There, you know, there's a lot of feeling of sadness, feeling of fear for our patients. And we really do, we're giving whatever count, you know, we've gotten them pictures. We've asked family members to drop off, you know, pictures to hang up in the room so that, you know, they could feel a little bit more at home. We've gotten, you know, we have iPads that we try and, you know, have the patients be able to, if they don't have a way to have a video chat with their family, we have iPads going around the whole entire hospital so that they have that ability to communicate with their family members. But again, we're very much encouraging for family and friends to reach out to the anyone who they know who's in the hospital. It's so uplifting, and it's so beneficial for the patients.
Thank you, Rabbi.
No, I was saying back at you.
Sorry about that.
I'll tell you, wearing one of my other hats and sort of blending them in between the rabbi and the therapist, there's a line that for a long time has sort of, you know, faded because of its lullaby effect, about its constancy, that we hear it all the time, we don't think about what it means. That the last of the Sheva Brachos, we say, Od Yishama Be'arei Yehuda, Be'arei Yehuda, V'chutzo, Yerushalayim. Please, you know, we'd like to hear once again the sounds of Chasanim and Kalas. And normally you hear the tune, and it's a very, very happy tune. And I was struck the other day thinking about it. Maybe the song came on when we were cooking for Shabbos or something. And I started to get a, you know, misty-eyed, although my children will tell you that I cry at the drop of a hat anyway. But the thought of Od Yishama Be'ar Yehuda, we want to hear that sound of a chasana again. We want to hear that sound of a chasana again. We want to hear the sound that we want to hear all the noise of a wedding, of a communal simcha, of a communal celebration again. That normally during this time, you know, a month before and a month after, Shir and I will be going to 3-4 weddings at a drop sometimes. And now it's not happening. And the thought of so much of what our communal life and the story of our communal lives right now really can be reflected in that item. That so many of the institutions of Orthodox Jewish life, of right, you know, life as a whole, but that definitely Orthodox Jewish life, which is so, you know, hinged on community, that there are these big gaping holes, of what to do. How do we celebrate? How do we mourn? Normally, under normal circumstances, when a person mourns, there's the moment of the day of abject pain and muted suffering known as aninus, the first day before the body is buried. And then there's the process of sitting Shiva, where people go to visit the mourners and try to console. And it's funny that the wisdom involved in the halachic system, that one does not even begin to try to console a mourner until after the body has been buried. One sees the Kubler-Ross stages of grief being played out over there, that first that there's an abject pain where the person tears their garments out of sheer loss, moving then on to the silence of aninut until the body is buried, and then only then will people attempt to try to comfort the mourner. They will come and stand in a line as the mourner walks past, as they say, you should be comforted, and then people visit them for 7 days, again comforted. The house is bustling with people coming to them night and day, trying to console the mourner, and then there goes back to a silence again. And there's this interplay as the person moves from the profound pain of their personal loss, then to once again resuming their lives fractured, but once again as part of a community. And now it's not there anymore. And for a lot of people in this time period, they don't know what to do. People, they don't know how to console their friends who are mourning, and they don't know how to mourn because these structures have been compromised. Our structures of celebration and mourning are missing. And as a result, we really don't know what to do. And I believe that In this vacuum, you know, it rests on us to try to figure this out in the same brave way that we're dealing with everything else that's very new and scary. In this way also, we have to try to to be, as Soloveitchik would put it, to be heroic, to stand in that breach of not knowing, of that lack of social impression, because we really don't know. We don't know what to do. What do you do when you can't pay a Sheva call? You want to reach out to the person. So then you call them on the phone, and that's weird, because it's very, very awkward to begin with to sit in a Sheva house. But that's the way it's supposed to be. I called one person who lost a family member, and I said to them, look, we're in very uncharted territory. So if you want to, I'll call back tomorrow. And if you want, we'll just sit on the phone not saying anything to each other. Or if you need, we'll talk. Or if you need to cry or scream, or again, just to sit here. Or if you want to talk about Star Wars right now, that's okay too. But to be brave like that, to be heroic, as Rav Soloveitchik would put it, because we're in uncharted territory, and we're just trying to find meaning amongst all of this. We're trying to make meaning. And when we try to make meaning, what we try to make sense out of all of this, so we know Viktor Frankl and his classic books on the search for the logos, for the search for meaning, is part of what helps us, you know, move through over here. They wanted to add to the stages of grieving, this is just as an aside, that there was a last stage after acceptance, is finding meaning. And you know, this is part of what we're looking to do right now. Back to you, Hodes.
Thanks, Rabbi. How has the pandemic changed the scope of your practice? We're going to start with Malka Aikenblatt.
So I think obviously that this pandemic is shifting how we see ourselves, how we see others, how we see the world. And I think that in therapy post the pandemic, we're going to have a lot of reference points for community strengths and how the community pulled together in many ways. We're going to have reference points for how people managed anxiety and all these skills that people are gaining, you know, through the therapy process or through support. Those are skills that they're going to need to refer back to and to accompany them in good times as well. I think it's also very interesting to think about how teletherapy is going to impact the community that has various disabilities and allowing therapy to be more accessible. I think there's a lot of interesting advocacy in the disability community that's going to come out of this. I think that evidence-based therapy, which is something that I've been so happy to see so much evidence-based modalities being disseminated through the internet. And when you think about it, if someone's living in an area where there's not a responsible care for the specific issue that they're struggling with, having access to this quality of care, I think it's going to be a really awesome shift. And I think my hopes is that we're also going to see kind of this grassroots movement of leadership where people in healthcare are going to fuel any kind of struggles that they've seen. And really, I think the world of policy can be shifted through some of the emotions we're experiencing here. And as research shows, that gratitude is highly helpful. So I think we're all going to experience, please God, this wave of gratitude or overcome us to some extent through this experience as well. And I think essentially the question is, you know, we could speak about these big broad ideas, but I think it's going to be a valuable psychological question for everyone to ask themselves, how can I use this experience to move forward in an effective way and perhaps in a new way with new strength.
Thank you for that. Basia?
So from the hospital perspective, it's very different from outpatient clinic. Get acclimating with the new resources that we're being provided with, because we're in the past, if a patient came in and needed a substance abuse referral, it's very, you know, encouraging a patient to make a phone call and showing up at an appointment. In a sense, this is almost easier for them because it's just a phone call and they're, you know, they're having this telephonic communication with a therapist. So it's almost in a way simpler for them rather than them leaving their house, going to an appointment. It almost simplifies the resource for the patient. In other aspects, you know, we're faced with a lot of challenges because patients who are being referred for subacute rehabs. So the media has portrayed it that, you know, the rehab centers are at fault for a lot of the deaths that have been going on, whereas we're the ones, you know, the rehab centers were forced to accept the patients. And they were very much against it, and they were forced to accept very ill patients, which did spread the virus in their facilities. And now family members are very hesitant to send their dear ones to one of these facilities. And so it's a lot of more negotiating with family members to see if they're able to accommodate these patients at home. You know, someone who was walking fully prior to their hospitalization and suddenly bedbound and needs a lot of physical therapy, it's a lot of negotiating with family and family members just taking on that responsibility at home for these patients. Whereas in the past, they would never have taken on this kind of a responsibility for someone who is returning home. So there are changes there. It's also providing a lot of supportive counseling for our patients who are dialysis patients, because in the past they were going to a specific site for dialysis, and now all of a sudden they're being rerouted to another one, and change might be very difficult for these patients. They're used to, you know, for years going to a specific site, and suddenly, you know, because they're positive, they're no longer able to go to that site. So it's a lot of working with the resources that we have and working with the changes that that come our way. A patient who is homeless, who walks into our hospital and is positive, is not able to go to a homeless shelter. So we have to find a hotel that the government is subsidizing for them to go to. So it's a lot of new resources. It's learning a lot of new information. And it's really as we go that we gain these new resources or realize that we lost resources. Patients who are, you know, are confused a lot of the times, and it's a lot of more communication with our patients. It's a lot more communication with family members, explaining, and, you know, it's a juggle. It's definitely a juggle for hospital social workers, because our caseloads have doubled since the virus came on. Our hospital took on almost an extra 400 to 500 patients. So it's giving even more attention to our patients than we did it in the past. But at the same time, balancing our enormous caseload. And it's definitely a challenge, but it's also such an amazing learning experience to see what programs are coming out of this, and seeing how everyone is coming together to create new resources for these patients. So it's definitely been on my end as a hospital social worker, a very positive experience to see how the community comes together to create new resources for these patients.
Thank you. Rabbi, for you to conclude.
Yes, some conclusion. Now firmly wearing my rabbinic hat, totally wearing my rabbi hat. That hasn't changed much, right? Sorry, somebody just asked for something in the other room. The time period that, you know, that we're living in, it is one of challenge. And really one of the most interesting pieces found in both the Midrash and the Zohar, it discusses how God created the world by first destroying the world and then creating the world again, and then doing it again and again and again, like six or seven times. And of course, the question that even one of the Midrashim even asks is, what's the point of telling me this proto-history? What do you need to tell me this? And the answer is found in teachings of the writings of Ishbitz, is that after the world has been broken, you know, what do you rebuild with the pieces? What do you rebuild with the pieces that are there? What can you build after everything's fallen apart? Well, we all find ourselves really and truly, you know, with a world that's fallen apart in many different ways. And the challenge of the moment is that after the breakage, after the failure, after things falling apart, how do we rebuild? What do we rebuild with? And again, with the patience and the understanding that we will have missteps, and that, you know, it'll take different amounts of times, and there's no timeline, but we're trying to rebuild. It's said that Rabbi Nachman walked around with his students after the town of Breslov had burned to the ground. Everything was made out of wood. They didn't have stones. And the place had burned to the ground. He's walking with the students, and they see one man digging in the ashes, digging in the ashes. And everybody's pointing and, you know, pointing at him and laughing. And Rabbi Nachman tells the students, look carefully. He's digging through the ashes, looking for a board or something to begin rebuilding. And the biggest blessing that I can give, that being a therapeutically informed rabbi, is that we should have the ability to find those boards, to find those pieces to rebuild with. And I have the knowledge and the patience with ourselves to engage in this rebuilding process, and to feel empowered that we ourselves can build, and we can rebuild, and we will rebuild, and we will rebuild the world which was even more awesome than the world from which we came. May we merit the healing, the wisdom, and the insight and the patience to be able to do so.
Awesome. Great. Okay. You can stay, but for a couple of questions, we're not going to be able to get to all of them, but highlighted a couple of important ones. So whoever kind of thinks of an answer or wants to answer it, has something to say, then just, I guess, unmute yourself. And if you unmute yourself at the same time as somebody else, just do the awkward thing where you guys fight it out. Like, you know, just do that thing. You guys know what I mean. Okay. So any advice for students? Specifically college students, but any advice for parents that have kids in school, how to keep to a certain schedule, or for like college students? I know many of us, because it switched online, a lot of us felt it a lot more because we weren't like used to what was going on. So any advice to end off the semester?
I have a comment that I meant to mention earlier. I'm glad you asked this question, Malka, or whoever asked this question, but I'm glad you brought it to my attention. Aside from the other strategies that we were talking about in terms of procrastination, motivation, a lot of students, really strong students that I'm working with, are struggling with anxiety and depression, managing it very well, and had to lean on few resources on campus. And now I'm encouraging them to rely more and to seek out more support from the supports that are already on campus. So the Center of Disability Services, the Learning Center, these are great resources that are still open to you. And even if in general, these are not services that you find that you need, I think this is an excellent time to seek out their support.
Yeah, it's very true. Does anyone else have anything to say? Okay, someone said that sometimes they have trouble eating during the day. Their schedule might have been like thrown off, or they're just either in a depressive mode or not really paying attention. Does anyone have anything to say about that?
I'm happy to say a couple of words about that. So one of the things that you can do to reclaim a little bit of control over your life is to control some of the basic things again, like your eating and your sleeping. So if things are thrown off, slowly try to get them back into some degree of control. So when we spoke about scheduling things, you can also schedule when you're going to eat. It doesn't mean that you have to have a huge meal, but eating small amounts of food throughout the day is always very, very important to maintaining all forms of your health. Do it nice and slow. Again, Rome wasn't built in a day, and the solutions to all of the problems associated with corona aren't going to be found in a day. So give yourself some time to do it slowly.
Awesome. That's so true. Thank you. This is a question for Dr. Margolis. Could you please give more concrete examples of using mindfulness and how you kind of like practice that with your clients?
Sure. So mindfulness, I know it's a very pop culture word. It really just means being in the present moment without judgment. So anything that really rivets your attention to the here and now is something that you can use to practice mindfulness. So when you're starting out, like focusing on breath for me was very hard in the beginning because I kept losing focus, but like playing a really fast paced game or blasting music and dancing and really throwing myself into that moment were ways that I was able to engage with the present much easier. So something that really pulls you in. I have a client that bought a Bop It, you know, throwback, because, you know, really requires focus and attention. And there's an app I just downloaded that's called Simon Says, which, you know, it just plays a tune and you have to follow and kind of tap along. So these are ways to, you know, practice an activity that really brings you to the present. Somebody, I forgot who, I think Malka maybe mentioned grounding techniques. So really using your five senses. So what do I see? What do I smell? What do I taste? What can I touch is another technique that people use. And another part of this is really noticing when you're starting to feel emotions come up and some judgments that come along with that. So judgments take us out of the present. So really trying to just label things as they are, like the facts as everybody would see it. The paper is white, not I like the paper, I don't like the paper, the paper is pretty, the paper is ugly. So we get stuck sometimes out of the present with should statements and judgments and labels, and really sticking to just what I see concretely with my senses is another really good way of staying focused on what's in the here and now.
Okay, great. Thank you. Thank you so much. Here's a question for Rabbi Boshnak. For those quarantining with your significant other, what are some ways to keep the peace and not get sick of each other? And yeah.
Yeah, so that this is something with which, you know, people are definitely dealing with. Not everybody is as blessed as I am to work with your spouse 24/7 for the last 14 years. So as a result, you know, it's a different experience for many people. So you need to, number one, it's a good idea to try to create some, on one hand, distant time to carve out some space for each other to have some space. Number one, sometimes you don't have to do everything together all 24 hours. That's A, just because you happen to be holed up in the same one bedroom apartment. But find space, make space for each other, number one. Number two, also spend some more time, you know, getting to know each other's patterns. If you find each other getting on each other's nerves, you'll probably notice that there's a pattern. There are certain recurring topics, certain recurring, as Dr. Sue Johnson likes to say, certain dances that you're involved in. There are certain fights that come over and over and over again. And even when it's not specifically about who's doing the dishes, it all comes back to the dishes, right? Or, you know, insert whatever other thing you want to talk about over there. But it comes back to the dishes. Each one of you has a dance. Each one of you has a dance that oftentimes Gottman refers to it as a negative feedback loop. That when you're doing something which is grating on each other's nerves or each other's minds, it's because there's a scar there. There's a tender tissue there. There's something in your relationship that you're pushing on. what, number one, ask yourself what's causing you to push on that. What is the action that's irritating your spouse, and vice versa? So you can divide it into two different interventions, as it were. One, give yourself some more time apart and better time together. I could also recommend look at John Gottman's Ask Open-Ended Questions. Asking open-ended questions is one of the cornerstones in Gottman's entire worldview, right? That you're getting to understand the person more. What's their internal map? What are they like? There are certain things we think we know about our significant other. We really don't know anything at all. So as we work, towards that, that's another piece. And a fourth piece of advice is find some way to make a date night. Don't take each other for granted. Yes, the both of you are together 24/7, but what can you do not to do the regular? Yes, there is the Netflix and chill, but just because you can Netflix and chill doesn't mean there should be 24 hours of Netflix and chill. What if instead of hanging out in sweatpants, you both got dressed up and made a steak together? A candlelight steak together. What would that be like if that's your thing? What would it be like? So those are four tips for you.
Great. Those are really, I love that. Great. Here is the last question. And after it's answered, anybody can really unmute. Like if any of our last panelists want to just add in something, a message to leave off with. But here's the last question. How can someone be more aware of like the point between fear and anger, and like where, like if they're channeling fear into like the wrong direction and like into like anger with people around us? So where is that like line of like that we draw, that we realize where exactly the anger is coming from?
I can take this one. So anger is often a secondary emotion, which means that it often comes after another emotion comes first. It can be our primary emotion when there's a physical pain or one of our goals are being blocked. For the most part, and sometimes it comes really right after sadness or right after fear. There's a variety of reasons for why anger would pop up right after these emotions. It's often what people learned. It's what got reinforced in their families, or it might feel safer for them, right? I don't know about you guys, but I'd rather be annoyed than anxious. So it might very nicely translate. So what I would say is, first and foremost, right, it's really about self-awareness. So if somebody notices that they're feeling irritable, really trying to figure out what that, Malky used the word trigger, right? So what that prompting event, what caused them to feel the way that they did? And if it's something that's related to, fear of emotional or physical well-being, it would most likely actually be a fear response rather than an anger response. And sometimes just identifying that and labeling it that I feel afraid or I feel nervous can actually reduce the emotion itself. Labeling an emotion, describing it, is actually one way to reduce an emotion. And that can actually be helpful to weed out whether or not it's fear or anger, trying to figure out what caused it.
Wow, great. Thank you. There was just one last question that someone asked. Does anyone have anything to add about those who have trouble sleeping due to anxiety? The specific example they used was kind of like dozing off, but then like kind of jerking back awake because of anxiety. Does anyone have any advice?
I think Miriam does.
Yeah, I think, thanks. I think, I'm pretending I'm back in school, elementary school. I think what we learned from this, the sleeping patterns is that what we do during the day affects us at night, and we'd be foolish to think that it doesn't. My one thing that I know has helped for me, turn off the news or just don't listen to it as often. We're taking in all of this stuff, and if you really think about it, very little of it is positive or uplifting or joyous. it's really not. So, you know, I know part of our need to feel in control is that we need to know what's going on, but we also know what they're reporting on the news is a lot of ambiguity and a lot of untruth anyway. So if we want to kind of check in and hear what's going on, I get it. But you know, I would err on the side of caution and just don't obsess about the news and try to get everything that you can. Because it just, like, I'll use the word that Abigail used before, it just triggers so much stuff that we're not even conscious of. And a lot of that unconscious stuff affects our sleep and then messes up our day.
Okay, thank you.
Can I
thank
add
you
something
so much
to that also? Yes. Yeah, yes, I love that. And I think it could help with a lot of other things besides for our sleep, just our anxiety in general, like, you know, avoiding the news or, you know, being mindful of when we're consuming it. I also think, like, when you wake up in the middle of the night and you look at the clock and then you start thinking, I only have this amount of time left to sleep. I only have this amount of time left to sleep. That's something that also can keep the anxiety around and interrupt your sleep. So as much as you can to try, you know, basic, you can actually Google, you know, I'll take a note of Miriam's book. You can Google sleep hygiene. There are a bunch of tips that will come up, like keeping your room cool, avoiding screen time an hour before bed. And if you can't sleep, get out of bed, go to another room, read a book. But watching the clock and thinking about how little time you have left to sleep is anxiety producing itself. So that's another thing I would be mindful of.
Good point. Yeah, thank you. Okay, so I think that's it for question and answers. If anyone wants to add in, feel free to unmute. No? Okay. So I just also wanted to highlight the importance of reaching out to friends. You know, the topic of, like, loneliness was brought up a lot. So I just wanted to kind of make, like, a mini commitment to myself, and then maybe we all can kind of do the same. We can reach out to at least 2 people a day, people that you either saw every day before quarantine, before the, like, you know, the laws were laid down, or like, you know, someone that you saw or someone that you haven't spoken to in a long time, but a simple text or a phone call definitely goes a long way. So, so that's what we're encouraging here, just to, you know, just 2 people, either to text or call. But yeah, now I'm passing it over to Samson.
All right. So we would like to thank our amazing panelists, Ronan Hazami, Miriam Turk, Penny Feintuch, Avigail Margolis, Malka Akinblit, Rabbi Reuven Boschnack, and Besa Brevda. We would also like to thank the OUJLIC of Brooklyn College, Alpha Epsilon Pi of Brooklyn College, Tanger Hillel of Brooklyn College, Stuck in the Library, Chai Club, Orthodox Club, and Link. Also, huge shout outs to everyone on the event committee, including Malko Kapilovich, Oria Abed, Perry Weissel, Mary Halavani, Samson Miller, Zach Nomer, Dylan Kosek, Muriel Tolkman, Moshe Bressler, Dorette Dayan, Ronnie Menashe, Chaya Kaimova, and a very special thank you to Sarah Yazdi and Hudi Harman for coordinating this event and designing the resource booklet, which is both in the chat for this Zoom and should have been emailed to everyone who registered beforehand.
Or will be afterwards.
Or will be afterwards.
This was a really nice way to spend the evening. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you all so much to our panelists. Again, thank you all so much for coming. And wonderful. Have a good night. Stay safe. Be well.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys. Good night.
OMG, thanks. Bye. Welcome to my bed. Okay, cool. Bye.
Night.
Rabbi Boschnack.
Yes. How are we doing?
How are you?
Doing well. How's it going?
Baruch Hashem. We are great. In Corona times. You have any good books to recommend?
Good question. Try Rav Aaron Lichtenstein. Mevakshei Panecha, seeking his presence is great.
I read it already. Should I read it again?
Yeah, absolutely. Leaves of Faith.
Leaves of Faith I don't own, unfortunately.
Great. Very great. Lila Tovall, to all a good night. Thank you to the committee. Thank you all. Zygazent, be well.
What?
Bye-bye, y'all. Bye, Mom.